Religious gatherings during the pandemic. What's legal and what's prudent? Last month's Supreme Court decision over New York's COVID restrictions was the biggest in a series of legal rulings about how states can or cannot regulate religious gatherings in the interest of public health. It's a decision especially relevant during this holiday season, when churches, synagogues, and other houses of worship are traditionally packed. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, what does this decision mean for Maine? We will talk with Maine's Attorney General, as well as a legal scholar, to put the issues of religious freedom versus public health into perspective. And we'll hear from faith leaders about their approach to worship during this pandemic. Will you be attending services this season? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Religious gatherings in Maine and nationwide have been altered due to the pandemic. Today, we'll talk about the legal and public health issues that arise over how houses of worship follow COVID restrictions. My guests, Aaron Fry, Attorney General for the state of Maine, and Maren Sorensen, Assistant Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. We invite your comments and questions. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to both of you, and thank you so much for being here, and happy winter solstice to both of you, a day in which the days start getting longer after this, so we can all celebrate. Maren, I want to start by asking you to give us a broad perspective of what's going on. There was the Supreme Court decision last month, and we'll go into that in detail, but talk about how this is being played out across the country, the balance between COVID restrictions and places of worship wanting to hold services in person.
Sure. Thank you for having me. And in brief summary, the court on November 25th, the Supreme Court, they granted emergency relief to churches in New York City that had sort of been under previously Governor Cuomo's sort of executive order that limited houses of worship differently than it limited other businesses. So from that, the sort of broad and simple takeaway is that if states or if cities are going to place COVID restrictions, because some states don't at all, I'm from South Dakota, they haven't at all placed any COVID restrictions, then you have to treat houses of worship, you have to treat them the same as you would treat other sort of essential businesses. So you cannot treat them differently and have lower occupancy limits in houses of worship than you would in, for example, grocery stores. That's the very basics of that.
Right. So if your limit is no more than 50 people in one place at one time, that's whether you're a church or a restaurant or a grocery store. I'm just giving an if.
Yes. And the court pointed out that it's actually probably a good idea to tie occupancy limits to the building size. So, you know, the 50 rule would be not a great rule, to be quite frank, because if you had 50 people in a building that's, you know, 1,000 square feet, that doesn't seem like a great idea. But 50 people in a building of 10,000 square feet actually might be a little bit overdoing it or underdoing it, I suppose, based on the perspective. So they said that, you know, a less restrictive means would be to actually tie the occupancy limits to what would be the fire code limit itself. So a fire code is 100 people and you want to say 50% of fire code or 25% of fire code, that has to be generally applicable across the board to the different types of businesses, gathering types, et cetera.
Aaron, did this Supreme Court decision affect what Maine was doing in any way?
It did not, and you know, sort of looking broadly, the governor and her office has been working very hard, communicative with not only members of the faith communities, but also with civic, public, leisure, the various communities that are touched by these restrictions. And there has been a lot of effort to calibrate what it is that's been ordered with what it is that's trying to be prevented here, which is a very contagious virus that is transmitted by human-to-human contact. And so we, you know, as has been the case since the beginning of our dealing with this pandemic here in the state, my office has been consulted by the governor's office. We're working to track what's going on, not only for similar regulations across the country that governors are having to manage, but also looking at the different litigation that's been taking place, the different lawsuits that have been brought. We, by the way, in Maine have been successful in defending the governor's executive orders to date. And I guess I have a little bit of a different read than Professor Sorensen about the 50-person limits. What we understood the Supreme Court order to say was, there are different options that may be used. And in this case, it actually contrasted what happened to New York with other states that had put in a higher limit. So New York at the time had like a 10-person limit for these buildings. The court in this case had differentiated the 10-person limit from a 50-person limit in another state that was allowed to continue. So all that being said, there has been a lot of attention to what it is that the courts have been saying. Certainly there was attention to this case from the Supreme Court. But because the effort has gone into these orders from the beginning, talking with faith communities, talking with, you know, other social gatherings and what and how they work, there's a high level of confidence that we're balancing the really significant public health risk with the important need for people to be able to exercise their faith, engage with others in social settings, which is recognized, of course, by the Constitution.
And, Maren, this is not the only Supreme Court decision recently that has to do with religious liberty versus public health, right? I mean, just this week, there were some orders. How do they apply, you know, how do they weigh into this whole thinking about what states ought to be doing?
So December 3rd and December 15th, the court remanded, so the court sent back down to the district court three separate cases, one from California, one from Colorado, and one from New Jersey, telling the district court now to apply the standard in the New York case that they decided November 25th. So this is, I suppose it's consistent in that way that they're you know, sending them back down and saying, apply this new ruling. But it is generally being viewed as the new court with Amy Coney Barrett replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg as being more friendly to religious institutions and more open to hearing these types of claims and granting emergency relief. So this is certainly a sign that this new court with six conservatives, even though Chief Justice John Roberts has been voting with the liberals, so it has been a 5-4 split, that this new conservative majority with Amy Coney Barrett is much more sympathetic to these sorts of religious claims.
In adding into that, if I may, I think it'll be interesting to see how these courts look at whether or not these restrictions were of general applicability, which the Supreme Court with the, you know, the Amy Coney Barrett, you know, the November 25th, what they said in New York was that this was not a generally applicable application, that they found that it was specifically targeted at houses of worship, right, the synagogue and the Catholic Church. That's different from what we're doing in Maine. I can't speak to what was going on in New Jersey, Colorado, and California at the top of my head, but to the extent that the Supreme Court put forward, you know, if you focus on churches, this is what we're saying has to happen. If you have a generally applicable, you know, so if you say all social gatherings, which of course include gathering for religious services, then it's not clear, at least from my read, that this clearly apply, that the Supreme Court decision clearly applies to that.
We're joined now, calling in Reverend Jane Field, who's Executive Director of the Maine Council of Churches. Thanks so much for joining us, Reverend Field.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
The Maine Council of Churches consists of Protestant congregations. Tell us your position on this issue about how to conduct church services during the pandemic, and especially guidance coming into the Christmas season.
Yes, we do represent most of the mainline Protestant denominations, about 437 churches in the state, representing 55,000 members. The vast majority of those are refraining from in-person worship, have been for some time, and we support those churches making that decision. It's prudent. It's in the interest of protecting the health and lives of our neighbors. And for us, the core value of our faith tradition is love of neighbor. So, you know, I hear people saying, well, you're banning people from gathering for worship. Actually, churches are gathering for worship every day and all day on Sunday using online platforms. They're using telephones for people that don't have internet access. Nothing is banning us from gathering. We're worshiping maybe even more than we did when we could gather in person. So we are encouraging churches to make that sacrifice as a way of living out their faith. You know, we don't go to church. We are the church. So we really encourage people to think outside the box about ways of worshiping that honor the lives and the well-being of our neighbors.
Reverend Field, have there been hard conversations about this, though? I think about how precious, for example, a candlelight service is to so many churches. Are there any within the Maine Council of Churches that are saying, we really, really, really want to be able to gather in person and be able to find a way?
Yes, it's a loss. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It is a sacrifice. Sacrifice means it's hard to do. So people are mourning and grieving what will be lost. Things will be gained. You know, we have shut-ins that haven't been able to attend a candlelight service for years, but now will be able to because they can join us through their computer screen. So, you know, it balances the sacrifice with the gains. Some churches are doing outdoor things, maybe ringing their bells and having people standing far apart in a parking lot. No singing, which, you know, that's a big sacrifice at the holidays for us. Singing is what causes super spreader events, even with masks on. So that is one thing we're adamant about, is that even those, like you said, who are trying to find a way to be together, whatever you do, don't sing. Please don't sing. And so there are some churches, but for the most part, people are recognizing, especially with the surge in cases and hospitalizations and deaths right now, it's just not safe or prudent to do.
Reverend Field, I'm sure you've been following the pastors, both here in Maine and across the country, who've been pushing back against restrictions. And these are also pastors of mainly Protestant Christian churches, not all. There's Orthodox Jewish congregations that are also pushing back. And I'm wondering what you would say to them. Do you understand their frustration and empathize with that?
I don't. I know that sounds harsh, but for the reasons I've just listed, which is they can gather online. They don't need to be in person. In the cases in Maine, you know, I'm thinking of the Sanford Church, for example, people got sick. People, including the father of the pastor, got ill. There's a Methodist pastor in Holton who lost his wife. They were following safety guidelines in that case, and she still lost her life. And he also contracted the virus, and they were hospitalized together. It makes no sense to me, knowing what I believe to be true about what the Christian gospel says we should prioritize, that we would put acts of piety and standing together in poorly ventilated indoor spaces without masks on. It somehow that's more important than protecting the lives of our neighbors and our community. It makes no sense to me.
So for you, this is not a matter of religious liberty?
No, not at all. It's simply not.
Well, Reverend Field, thank you so much for calling in. Reverend Jane Field, Executive Director of the Maine Council of churches. Maren, I want to turn to you. The First Amendment and religious liberty is at the core of so many controversial debates in our culture right now, whether it has to do with religious schools or the placement of, say, for example, nativity scenes in public places. How does what's going on here during this pandemic and the different states issuing different regulations about gatherings, how does this sort of play into the national historical debate over the meaning of the First Amendment?
Sure. So Attorney General Frey brought up a few of the critical phrases. So he said generally applicable. Our current, the current sort of court standard for laws are that, you know, if you're going to regulate any sort of church activity, First Amendment activity, you can do so with generally applicable and neutral laws, where neutral means it's neutral towards religion. And this comes out of a series of cases from the 1990s. 1990 was a case in Oregon where a couple of individuals were fired from their jobs for ingesting peyote as part of religious ceremony. And prior to that point, the court had applied what's called strict scrutiny, which is a very difficult standard to pass. And strict scrutiny requires that you demonstrate that your law that's going to infringe on a First Amendment right has a compelling government interest and that it is narrowly tailored to meet the outcomes and the goals of the law. And that is the standard that the court applied in the November 25th case, because as Attorney General Frey said, those targeted religion. They were not generally applicable. They were not neutral with respect to religion. So the court then said, okay, do you have a compelling government interest? Actually, yes, you do. Trying to prohibit the spread of this deadly virus is a compelling government interest. But have you approached it in a narrowly tailored fashion via least restrictive means? No, you haven't, because you are burdening houses of worship disproportionate to the way that you are burdening other businesses and gatherings. So in the sort of broad spectrum of the way that the United States has dealt with, at least in legal terms, this idea of the interplay between religious freedom, First Amendment rights, liberties, is a huge shift in 1990 away from this requiring a compelling interest at all times towards, is it a generally neutral and a generally applicable and neutral law? And if it is, and it burdens religion, well, that's too bad, because it burdens everybody equally. And so we kind of, at this point in time, you know, we're 30 years later, it seems as if we might be going through another shift in the way the court views religious cases, maybe a little bit further back towards the old standard from the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s of this strict scrutiny. Do you have a compelling government interest? And have you tried to narrowly tailor that law and make it as least restrictive as possible? So it seems like the court membership is there to have this shift back to a more conservative standard that is more protective of religious freedom.
And I want to talk more about that, but we do need to go to a break. If you'd like to join this conversation about balancing the interests of church or state during a pandemic, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from SPACE, an arts nonprofit offering virtual events and public art initiatives during COVID-19. Space538.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael J. Fox talks about his new memoir, No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. It's about his recent life and how it's been affected by Parkinson's disease, which he was diagnosed with in 1991 at the age of 29, when he was famous for the hit sitcom Family Ties and the international blockbuster Back to the Future. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 8 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public's new All Books Considered Book Club connects readers across Maine. Our virtual book discussions are hosted by members of the Maine Calling team and feature an opportunity to hear directly from the author. We invite you to join us. For complete details on the book club, including our inaugural reading selection and how to sign up, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the show, religious gatherings in a time of COVID. What are the legal and public health issues? Joining me, Maren Sorensen, who is assistant professor of government at Bowdoin College, and Aaron Fry, attorney general for the state of Maine. Share your comments and questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And just a note to say that we did reach out to some of the church leaders who have stated that they believe they should not have to follow the state's COVID restrictions. We are hoping that they will call in today to share their thoughts. Aaron, before the break, we were talking about the shift in the potential shift in the court again now, 30 years after an important decision in 1990. I had a sense that you wanted to jump in, but had to go to a break. Go ahead.
Thank you for that. And I do want to highlight something that Professor Sorensen has hit on, which is there's a line in the majority opinion that reads, members of this court are not public health experts, and we should respect the judgment of those with special expertise and responsibility in this area. The very next sentence says, but, right? So the, you know, in terms of this shift that is being predicted, there seems to be this, we have a very serious virus. It's very contagious. It is propelled by human-to-human contact. In particular, social gatherings where people come together, spend time together, talk with each other, are communal. It just allows this virus to spread. And the Supreme Court has indicated that they know what they're not, and they're not going to let them stop. That's not going to stop them from moving in a direction that continues to allow these gatherings to happen. I also want to stress that there is a lot of recognition. I know this from my own work. There's recognition from the governor's office, certainly from my office. It is so important for people to be able to access their faith and their faith communities in this time of stress and uncertainty. So that's recognized. At the same time, we have to balance that with a very contagious virus. And so while the Constitution, it does protect different types of gatherings, different types of expression, when there is such a significant public risk, the government can't just stand by and let it happen. And so that's why, particularly when we understand that the court seems to be moving in a different direction, we hope that the court will continue down the path that it had started to go down with the orders prior to the 25th of November, that recognize that, you know, that restrictions that occupancy or gathering restrictions in place, they are a appropriate tool to use when trying to prevent this significantly dangerous virus.
Calling in now is the Most Reverend Robert Dealey, who is bishop with the Portland Diocese. Thank you so much for joining us, Bishop Dealey.
You're welcome, Jennifer. It's good to be with you. Thank you for calling me.
Could you please talk about the Roman Catholic Diocese's philosophy on what churches ought to be doing about following COVID guidelines?
I think the COVID guidelines are extremely important because they are about the health and safety of the people of Maine, and therefore the people for whom I am responsible, who are the Catholics of Maine. At the same time, I do think that people have a need for the worship that we do together, and I think that is enshrined in the Constitution and the First Amendment. We have been trying to balance those things, and so therefore, on the 1st of June, we began to have in-person worship according to the limits set by the governor, which are 50, and and it went up to 100 during the summer and went back to 50 again. And it is important to note that we have followed the guidelines, that people are wearing masks while they are at mass. They are socially distanced. We allow no, we discourage any kind of communication. We ask people to come from their cars to the church and to depart after Mass. We have no social gatherings or anything of that nature. It is simply to come together for the worship and prayer, which can only happen in that context. And that, to me, is the constitutional issue. And I think it is important to note that, despite other conversations that have been held this morning, we have had no outbreaks in our Catholic churches. No one has gotten sick because they have attended Mass.
Bishop Dealey, though, it's tricky to know that, isn't it? Because, for example, the state is even unable to do contact tracing right now because there's such community spread.
Well, nobody has told us that they got sick because of they were. I don't know what the situation is with contact spreading. We take those lists. We have those things. If the state is interested in thwarting this disease, then it should be looking at those contact lists that we have taken. Controversy, we have contact lists. We take the contact lists. If the state wants to know if somebody is in and somebody reports that they got sick at church, then the state should be calling us and asking for the contact list. That has not happened.
Okay.
So I mean, I think that I can say that with confidence under those circumstances.
Let me ask you this. I know that there's been some frustration, for example, among store owners who feel as though a store clerk shouldn't be put in the position of enforcing a mask mandate. Have there been similar kind of situations in churches? Is there a discomfort with within the church of enforcing when people do take off masks, when people do, hug, do things that are before the COVID-19 pandemic usual and regular during a service?
We've asked people not to. We've been pretty successful with the mask mandate, but we have also asked people who can't now that we have this new mask mandate. We've asked people who, for health reasons, can't wear a mask to attend Mass live stream, because we do have live stream as well. So we are offering, because obviously we have 245,000 self-professed Catholics in the state, that's a large part of the population, and I'm responsible to see to it that they're able to worship as they wish.
Bishop Dealey, we have an email coming in from Lee. He writes, "I'm a parishioner of the Catholic Church in the Biddeford Saco area. My family hasn't been to Mass in person since March, but we watch virtually every week. We are finding that the priests and lectors are not wearing masks during most of the service. I've brought it up, but the priests say that they have a special exemption from the bishop." So is that indeed the policy for the priests and the lectors?
The people who are speaking, the priest and the lectors, so that people can understand and hear them, are not wearing masks when they're doing that. But they're sufficiently socially distanced from anyone else that it is within the health guidelines that are given.
Let me ask you broadly, Bishop Dealey, how you feel about the restrictions that the state has imposed, and then just about the government response to the pandemic generally. Do you feel as though these restrictions are responsible and prudent, or do you feel as though they go too far?
I have asked since the beginning and have tried to have a conversation. It's interesting, the Attorney General says that there have been conversations. I had one telephone call with the governor back in March or April, and the further contact with her has not been available, and I have not been asked my opinion on any part of this. I have asked that the capacity, in accord with what your expert, Mary Sorensen, was speaking about, that the capacity for worship be consistent with proportionality. We have churches that hold 2,000 people. The cathedral holds 800 people. We were quite successful managing that with 100 people. We would be in New Hampshire, they're 50%. They have a capacity rate for church of 50%. In Massachusetts, 40%. Why does Maine feel it has to do it differently?
So you would like to be able to see, for example, at the cathedral in Portland, more like 200 people, maybe closing off every other pew or something like that?
No, I'd like it to be proportional, so we could have more people. We'd still have to socially distance and all the rest of that. Capacity would depend upon what happens once you socially distance once you make sure that you're socially distanced and you've closed off the benches that you need to close off. I think this is too restrictive, and I wonder why why Jane Field would think that who is with Maine Sounds of the Churches would think that religious liberty is not part of this, when in fact when nobody complained about all of the demonstrations, which were certainly within the First Amendment as well. I mean, this is definitely a First Amendment issue, and we were told when people were demonstrating in great numbers in the spring that's a First Amendment issue. This is a First Amendment issue as well.
But before we let you go, Bishop Dealey, I know this is the busiest season of the year for you. I just want to ask Attorney General Fry if there's anything that he would like to say in response to what you've said about the governor and about the state. Fry?
Yes, thank you. No, so I regret to hear that the bishop doesn't feel heard. I was privy to some communication in November in which there had been an exchange, at least of letters, between the bishop and Commissioner Lambrew of DHHS, in which it appeared to me as though the administration had heard the concern and provided the response. I think when I was talking earlier about the communication, as the bishop himself identified, there has been an evolving application of these executive orders in an effort to recognize what is happening in our state with COVID-19. And so to the extent that information is received and processed and leads to the modification of executive orders, that's really what I was talking about. And what's been communicated to me is that there has been attention to communications, whether they be by phone, by email, by mail. And I regret to hear that the bishop doesn't feel heard in this process.
Well, I think the other part of that is that in that letter that you refer to, the earlier Supreme Court decisions were referenced. The more recent were not, and of course they weren't because they hadn't yet been issued. But I do think that those newer decisions do, as Mary Sorensen pointed out at the beginning of the program, certainly do make a difference in the guidance that we're being given, and I hope that will be taken into account.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate Bishop Robert Dealey of the Portland Diocese calling into Maine Calling today.
Oh,
yeah, go ahead, Mary.
Can I clarify one thing?
Yes.
So the Supreme Court opinion did not mandate that occupancy limits were linked to building size, but it suggested that would be something that makes sense. They write, among other things, the maximum attendance at a religious service could be tied to the size of the church or synagogue. So they use language that is could be. So this wasn't a mandate that happened. It was a suggestion of a way to, I mean, the court says things like this because it's a way that you know that you would appease the court. So a state could maintain strict occupancy limits that are 50-person, 100-person, or it could, because the court mentioned it and you maybe want to appease the court, you could adopt maximum attendances that are related to the size of the church or synagogue.
The other thing that the court provided is that there were far more restrictive COVID-related regulations that had previously come before the court, recognizing that the court had before it 50-person limits in the past that were not touched, but this 10-person to 25-person limit was too restrictive. So going to what Professor Sorensen was saying, the states have been left in a situation here where they have to make decisions on how to protect this spread from happening. There hasn't been that sort of overall national guidance from the state level, from the national level. So states have had to make these decisions that are directly related to what they're experiencing in their communities. Some use the gathering limits of a set number. Some use a percentage. Some do a split, like Maine has a split, and it's tied to the experience. And so I don't agree with those who read the Supreme Court order as being the spike in the end zone that the state can't put gathering limits of set gathering limits. Now, I really don't think that that's a fair reading of what the Supreme Court said.
All right, Bishop Dealey, you're still there? You have something
yes,
you'd like
I
to
am.
Say before you go? Go ahead.
No, I do think I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to try to interpret the Supreme Court. I'm just following the what I'm reading, and I think that I still would prefer that the guidance be connected to proportionality, and I see if other people are able to do it and remain safe, I'm not sure why we can't.
All right. Well, Bishop Robert Dealey of the Portland Diocese, we do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com. And the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu.
I'm Marcy Bernard on the development team at Maine Public, and on this day in Maine history, each year since 1971, Maine officially celebrates the achievements of Chester Greenwood. An inventor and entrepreneur from Farmington, Greenwood was 15 when he designed his first pair of ear protectors out of wire, beaver fur, and cloth. At the age of 19, he acquired a U.S. patent. By age 28, Chester Greenwood & Company factory was producing and shipping Champion ear protectors worldwide. A prolific inventor, the spring steel grass rake, a version of a fluid shock absorber, and a folding bed were just a few of the products that resulted from his tinkering. Happy birthday, Maine.
On this day in Maine's history was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries, the Maine Maritime Museum, and listeners like you.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. 20 months after a fire tore through the majestic Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, an art restorer from Chicago is using lasers to wipe away soot from the cathedral walls.
The molecules get so excited by the energy they absorb, they literally shake themselves apart and just vaporize off the surface.
Restoring Notre Dame next time on Here and Now.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 12 noon here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Religious Freedom and Public Health During the Pandemic. Joining me, Maine Attorney General Aaron Fry and Maren Sorensen with Bowdoin College. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now is Molly Curran-Rolls, who is Executive Director of the Jewish Community Alliance of Southern Maine. Molly, thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks for having me.
We've talked a little about the Supreme Court decision on the case involving an Orthodox Jewish community. Can you tell us about that case a little bit more and what your reaction was here in Maine?
So there are some in the Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox community nationally who interpret Jewish law in a particular way that is, I would say, different than the majority of organizations and institutions here in Maine. In Jewish law, there's a concept of pikuach nefesh, which is the idea that the preservation of human life supersedes almost all laws. There's also a principle from the Mishnah that he who saves one life saves the world. So for many Jews and Jewish organizations, these concepts have provided a framework that supports following the recommendations of scientists to keep everyone as safe as possible. Certainly there are those who would interpret these to really in here more narrowly, so that this would only be something that you would want to turn to save a specific life in a specific situation rather than apply them in a situation like this when we know gathering in general does pose significant risks of loss of life. So there is, you know, Judaism is not monolithic. There certainly are different approaches and perspectives raised by different groups. But here in Maine, I think there's more of a consensus to honor these principles by following the guidelines as they've been laid out and really severely curtailing or not at all engaging in indoor worship at this point.
How in general have Jewish congregations been dealing with the health restrictions during the pandemic and especially now during Hanukkah?
So those whose observance is consistent with online gatherings have been holding services online regularly from Shabbat on Friday night and Saturday mornings to holiday gatherings in some cases. A lot of people did Zoom Seders. That was a big thing this April. And for Hanukkah candle lighting, there were some great activities virtually, including some statewide candle lighting gatherings, which are really nice. There also have been some outside activities. I know there was a Hanukkah parade of cars decked out with menorahs that drove by in Portland. And one of the temples in Portland, Bethel, which is a conservative synagogue, also has done quite a bit online, but had a series of in-person outdoor gatherings this past week for Hanukkah as well.
All right. Well, and I want to be clear, Hanukkah ended on the 18th, not now during Hanukkah, but in this past week. And I just wanted to ask if you feel if those in the Jewish community as a whole are supportive of the state's public health measures.
Yes, I would say I think rather than focusing on trying to avoid or change the restrictions in the Jewish community, we've seen a lot of collaboration as people work to capture ways for the community to safely remain connected and a lot of innovation and creativity in finding new avenues to do that.
All right. Well, Molly, thank you so much for calling in today. Molly Curran-Rolls, Executive Director of the Jewish Community Alliance of Southern Maine. We're going to go up to Freeport now. And Julie, hi, Julie, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Lots of people know us as Mormons. And to me, those who are so vehemently against masks and social guidelines, I think are being swayed more by their politics than by their religious beliefs and faith. Because our world global leaders have come out to say that, I'll just quote one of them. He says, "We as individuals and families and as a church will be judged by how we treat the vulnerable and disadvantaged in our societies. As the COVID-19 pandemic spreads around the world, it wreaks havoc among those who are already disadvantaged. Sadly, responses to the pandemic have been politicized and contentious. Our responses need not be. Wearing a face covering is a sign of Christ-like love for our brothers and sisters." And I really, truly believe that. And I feel like our church system here has been supportive of those guidelines, and they really have kept us safe. And I think that if we can just listen to each other and have that desire to help one another through this, whether it's respecting our First Amendment rights, and in addition to following the guidelines, they don't have to be mutually exclusive. You can have both.
And Julie, do you feel as that most people in your congregation feel the same way you do?
I do. I think there's definitely some people who push back, and especially if you look at our religious beliefs, not religious beliefs, I apologize about that, our community, maybe nationwide, there might be some people who would push back against it. But again, I don't think that's a reflection of our religion or even of what our general doctrines and gospel teach. I think that's a reflection of the political alliances that people have.
Julie, thank you so much for calling in and adding your perspective. I really appreciate it. Julie, a member of Latter-day Saints. Maren Sorensen, I want to come back to you and talk a little more fully about the shift that may be underway in this country. Of course, the decisions this past month, the first with Amy Coney Barrett joining the court. And I'm wondering what is coming up that you're watching?
Oh, my goodness. You know, there are some of not the Trump cases per se, the census case was kind of kicked to the side by saying that, we don't actually know if the Trump administration will be able to implement this change in census policy, so we're going to wait and see. I have to be honest, the religion is the area that I'm most
Concern isn't the right
word. And I'm
word.
Sorry, I didn't ask my question well. I meant in terms of religious liberty. Are there more cases are coming up?
You know, I don't know of any right off the top of my head, but it is an area that I will watch very closely, because I think by this point, even a casual court observer knows about Amy Coney Barrett's strongly held religious beliefs. And even though, and it's the phrase that everyone says that, during nomination confirmation process that, my personal religious beliefs don't play into my judicial philosophy. I think that people are going to watch very closely, and people are going to see also the way that she writes. Right. So it's one thing to look at the way that she votes. It's another thing to look at the way that she writes. And the questions that she might ask during oral arguments, to see kind of where she plays out in religious cases, because people are saying that she's probably going to be at least as conservative as Scalia, and possibly even more conservative than Scalia, placing her way on the far right of the ideological spectrum out there with Thomas. Thomas has been holding out the far right wing. He's way out there ideologically. He was more right than Ruth Bader Ginsburg was left. And so it's possible that he will have a new fellow out there with him, and that she will be possibly, that conservative. So I think, rather than watching particular cases that, right now I don't know of any off the top of my head, it's possible Attorney General Frey or caller knows one. I'm going to be just sort of watching her behavior more generally. As I said, what questions does she ask? And if she is assigned a majority opinion, what does she write? If she's not assigned a majority opinion, does she write separately? We maybe would assume that she'd be concurring because they'd be in the majority. And what are the sorts of cases that she's citing when she's writing? And those will be the things that I'm going to pay attention to, because I do genuinely think that the court goes through these sort of tectonic shifts in its, the way it kind of views different areas of law. They're fluid. They're not set in stone. And religious freedom seems to be like it's on the precipice of big change. So that's what I would be watching for.
I'm going to go to Annie calling from Portland. Hi, Annie. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that my family attends Catholic and Greek Orthodox churches, mostly in Portland. And I wanted to reiterate what the bishop said, that the leadership is doing a fantastic job really hard work of keeping us all safe. So I wanted to thank the leadership of both states across the state for that.
Annie, thank you so much for calling and joining the conversation. We'll go to Bangor and Larry. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm old enough to remember when West Virginia decided whether President Kennedy could become president because he was Catholic. I'm very, very fearful that the right to proselytize will be coming the right to impose with Coney Barrett. And I would hope that one of the professors or some of your guests would have some sort of comment on that.
All right. And Maren, is this what you were talking about?
I guess I don't. We have the Establishment Clause. So we have, religious freedom and religious establishment are separately listed in the First Amendment, where religious freedom, of course, protects your individual right to worship, and religious establishment ensures that we don't have any sort of endorsement of religion. So you can't favor religion over non-religion. So I think my biggest concern specifically with religious freedom is the tension between religious freedom and the new and hard-fought rights for the LGBTQ community. Because Alito and Thomas are on the record as saying that they think that these newfound rights and protections for the LGBTQ community are actually infringing upon religious freedom. And so I think that specifically is more of my concern than having, an additional religious member on the court would enshrine a sort of right, you know, a general right to infringe on, you know, non-religious entities. It's more this concern of the tension between religious freedom and protections for the LGBTQ community.
Larry, thanks for calling in. One of the many reasons we decided to do this program is recently we had Dr. Shaw on the program, and we had people calling in and emailing in and asking what they could do. A woman from named Lisa said that she attends a church in Waterville that was not enforcing COVID guidelines. Attorney General Aaron Fry, what can someone do if they are feeling unsafe at their place of worship, believe that the guidelines are not being followed, other than just leave?
Well, that is one thing, right? I mean, the other thing is that we all have a responsibility to be keeping our neighbor safe. And if you're a member of a congregation that is not being as attentive to the lawful orders that have been put in place about, you know, around masks and gathering limits, you should talk with your leader, your faith leader, about how this is making you uncomfortable as you practice your faith, and how it's just as important that you stay healthy as it is that you are able to practice your faith. You can certainly call in to report to the CDC that this is happening. I guess, you know, there has been a significant effort. There has been communication with different faith leaders, attorneys for faith leaders, and everybody seems to be communicating that they want to keep their parishioners safe and that they will work to follow these lawful orders. And so again, if they're not, let us know. We the state has communicated with those entities that, and of course, faith is one thing, but all, you know, there's also stores. There's other social gatherings where these
right.
same sort of lapses might happen.
I don't see you, hear you, and I'm sorry to rush you because we're almost out of time. But I don't hear you saying call the police.
You can't. I mean, the concern is we'd like the opportunity. The state needs to have the opportunity to talk with folks who maybe haven't had the benefit of that conversation.
Okay.
And we're finding that education is a powerful tool in working towards compliance with these lawful executive orders.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you both of you for being with us for the hour. That's Aaron Fry, the Attorney General for the State of Maine. Also with us, Maren Sorensen, an Assistant Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. You can visit mainecalling.org for more information about our programs or to sign up for our podcast. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.